Yep.
Good afternoon. We'll call this meeting of the Education Finance Committee to order. The first order of business will be approval of the minutes. Representative Anderson has reviewed the minutes from January 25th and moves their adoption. Are there any corrections, changes, or additions? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Members, today we are taking additional testimony in the area of legislative priorities. First on our list is we have the Brian Sweeney from Charter School Partners. Welcome to the committee, and just a little friendly reminder, we are on TV today, so no obscene gestures, please. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Brian Sweeney with Charter School Partners. Charter School Partners is a new nonprofit charter support group here in Minnesota. Can you hear this okay? We are less than 2 years old. Our mission is to nurture and grow high-performing charter schools in Minnesota with a focus on closing the achievement gap and demonstrating nationally recognized excellence in academics and business. Our goal is to close the achievement gap between white and low-income minority students, two, increase the number of high-performing charters in the state, and three, to increase the number of at-risk children being served by high-performing charters in Minnesota. We have two distinct initiatives. You'll see on the video or in your packet there. One is called Minnesota Charters for Urban Excellence, which we call MINQ, and the second is what we call a new Community of Excellence, or a Good to Great initiative, all for charter schools. Our MINQ initiative is designated to support startup schools serving urban communities from inception of the initial idea of a charter school through the end of the first year of operation. It can be a 2 to 3 year relationship that we work with schools. MINQ will significantly increase, we believe, the likelihood that a new school will be successful in delivering high academic outcomes and closing the achievement gap. We have modeled our efforts after the New Schools for New Orleans organization, which is a incubator for new charter schools. We are the Walton Family Foundation partner here in Minnesota, which means that we've put together a committee and we take applications for new schools. And Walton gives up to $250,000 of startup monies for new charters. And actually, they've refocused their efforts and they have kind of doubled down. And they actually give up to $500,000 to a new school through year two based on their academic performance as well as their attendance. In the last, this last year, through our committee, Walton gave $800,000 to four new charter schools that are starting up within the next year. Our second initiative is called our Good to Great program, or our Community of Excellence. We have 20 partner schools, including Harvest Prep, Higher Ground, Concordia Creative Learning Academy, Hiawatha Leadership Academy, which are some of the highest performing charter schools in Minnesota. We focus our efforts on the education excellence pillars of data-driven cultures, strong school leadership, high-quality teachers, proven national best practices, as well as effective board governance. We've added the board governance component to our efforts because a charter school is a nonprofit organization, a 501c3 nonprofit organization that has a board of directors with the very, very specific mission of running charter schools. Our 20-plus schools community of excellence really surpass the state average as far as the proficiencies and test scores in every category, working with African-American, Hispanic, white, ELL, FRL. And here is another way of looking at our schools and community of excellence. On the far right, you'll see St. Paul, Minneapolis, and state achievement levels versus our schools of excellence. A quick history of charter schools, and Joe Nathan's here and is going to speak after me. And he was in the front lines early on, and you know, can tell some, has a lot of stories to tell and background and information on how charter schools started in America. Over 20 years ago, American Federation teacher president Albert Shanker proposed autonomous schools led by teachers, eventually called charter schools. Our own Citizens League, Ted Coldery at the time headed it up, studied the committee, worked with Governor Perpich, who liked the idea, thought it was nifty, as he used to say, and the Citizens League published a landmark charter school proposal in 1989. And as you all know, the Minnesota legislature passed the first charter law in the nation. And in 1992, Milo Cutter opened City Academy High School in St. Paul, the first charter school in the nation. The first 10 years of the charter movement was really a focus on choice and innovation. And today we have a tremendous amount of different types of charter schools in Minnesota. We have project-based, constructivist models, many of them that do very well, arts-infused, core knowledge schools, language immersion schools, and in a lot of ways, our charter law has precipitated a lot of great innovation and choice opportunities. From 2002 to 2008, there was a rapid expansion nationally of charter schools. Here we see from the year 2002 to about 2006, a doubling and almost tripling of the number of charter schools throughout the nation. Here in Minnesota, during that period, in approximately 2004, we found a new focus of charters that expanded into cities in Minneapolis, St. Paul, as well as the suburbs. That was a focus, a lot of them focused on core knowledge, language immersion, performing arts charters flourished. We saw the likes of St. Croix Prep and Stillwater, Padilla Academy and Apple Valley, St. Paul Conservatory performing artists, Yinghua, which was featured in Time Magazine last year, Beacon Prep, Aspen Academy, Nova Classical in St. Paul. Here's a few facts you can maybe look at later. We have approximately 179 charter schools in Minnesota presently that serve 35,000 children. It is approximately 8.4% of the schools that serve approximately only 4.3% of all school children in Minnesota. It's higher for minority students, about 8.5% of minority students attend charters, limited English language, about 11.4%. Here is a chart, a bar graph that shows the new schools per year over the 19-year period. And again, you will see a great influx from about 2003 to 2005, where it says 6 years, under 6 years, it says 18, 17, 20 new schools were formed in some of those years. This only goes up to 2008. In 2009, there were four new charter schools that were formed. In 2010, there was only one. And 2011, there is the projection at this point is there will probably be three new schools opening up this fall. Charter schools generally have served more minority children, a percentage of minority children, As you can see here, MDE statistics from a couple years ago, and they're consistent with the present numbers. 52% charter schools serve 52% minorities, whereas district schools 22%. Similar to FRL, ELL, and special ed. The Minneapolis district and St. Paul districts, however, where there's a large concentration of charter schools, in Minneapolis, 22% of all Minneapolis school children are charter schools, and in St. Paul, 15% of all charter school children are 15% of the population are charter schools. In 2008, there was a legislative auditor report, which was the first slap, wake-up call, perhaps, to the charter community. In short, very short, it said that charter schools did not perform as well as mainstream public schools, and that they suffered from poor oversight. Now, we could dig deeper, a little deeper, in those numbers, and as the numbers we just showed, charters did serve a larger number of at-risk children and underserved children. However, no excuse.
Mr. Sweeney, just a quick question. Can you go back two slides, please? On the bottom there, you show the Minneapolis and St. Paul school districts, and you say number of district schools, percent enrolled, and then you list the percentage of students, the percentage of minority, and the percent free and reduced lunch. I just want to make sure I understand this, that in the Minneapolis school district, the charter schools that are contained within that geographic boundary, you're saying that one quarter of your students are on the free and reduced lunch program just within the charter schools?
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Correct. Again, the 2008 legislative auditor report. Signal Null was not right with the charter community. As we mentioned, in May 2009, Charter School Partners formed. One of the, we're very focused on data-driven methods and facts. We put together this graph. On the bottom, you'll see 0 to 100, and that represents proficiency. And on the left side, 0 to 20, the y-axis represents number of years in operation. And you'll find a large percentage, a large amount of charter schools in the upper left-hand corner. We had charter friends of ours that said, you can't show this information. It's too damning. Data is data. And again, I think this confirms a little bit that we had some work to do. Here's the reading proficiency chart as well. Quick overview. In 2009, the Minnesota Charter School legislation passed. And Eugene Piccolo is here, and he's going to get into more detail on the specifics of the 2009 law. Or Representative Slocum could talk about it, given her expertise in this area. It was passed with the full support of the charter leaders and charter community. The focus was to improve the level of business and academic quality, ratchet up the quality and achievement, and the standards of charter schools. And the state law really reflected best practices. It took the best practices that the National Alliance of Public Charter Schools and the National Association of Charter School Authorizers put together. And one of the criteria, one of the components of the new law was that all authorizers would need to re-up, to reapply, to become authorizers. And again, Eugene will get into that a little more. Minnesota's state of denial. Gosh, in the last week only, we've heard from Secretary Duncan questioning Minnesota's sense of urgency in addressing the achievement gap. A new charter reform group called MinCam reiterated the reality of the achievement gap. In January 2011, Education Week gave Minnesota a D-plus on its efforts to improve teaching quality. And not to pour it on, there was another report in January 2011 by the Thomas B. Fordham Institute report, and this and the Star Tribune actually did an editorial on this. I'll read the findings, the summary. In a recent study of 10 states, Minnesota was found to have the highest rate of persistently low-performing charter and district schools and the lowest rate of closing these schools in the country. That combination illuminates the need for Minnesota educators and school communities to stop giving lip service to efforts to close the achievement gap by taking stronger action with poor-performing schools. They need to use proven educational models and throw out methods that don't yield results while getting tougher, while closing schools and starting over when necessary. Where do we go from here the next couple of years? The National Alliance for Public Charter Schools has stated that Minnesota has the best charter law in the nation 2 years in a row. Last week it was announced that it got its second award. The National Association for Charter School Authorizers, NASCA, gave Minnesota's new charter law an award for the 2009 revisions, and I believe Representative Slocum, you accepted the award. So, congratulations. We're not coming today with a legislative agenda. I guess in generally, we have the nation's best charter law. And one suggestion would be, first, do no harm. Let's let the 2009 law be implemented. You know, there of course will be tweaks to it, there are going to be some, I know, this legislative session. I think many in the charter community have been part of the alternative certification coalition, and we're finding our focus really coincides with the larger education reform agenda, which includes alternative certification, perhaps reciprocity with other states, early childhood, etc. One thing I can point out as part of our teacher focus with charter school partners, we were partners with Teacher America in placing TFA core members into charter schools in the Twin Cities. And I believe Daniel Sellers has mentioned that there are approximately 90 core members in Minnesota, and 55 of them presently are in charter schools. And again, that was one of our initiatives that we were involved in. As shown in some of the previous graphs, the new charter approvals have slowed, but as we retool with this new state law, I think they will increase in the coming years. Where do we go from here? Again, we have this graph of the x-axis is low to high performers, and the y-axis is new and mature schools. We put together this matrix as a strategy for our organization, but also additional strategy for education reform in Minnesota. And a couple months later, President Obama came out with his RTTT proposal and our Race to the Top proposal, and our copyright attorneys chose not to go after the administration because we had put together the exact same strategy, which includes working with good schools and helping them become great. And we talked about our schools of excellence and community of excellence. And with the magic of PowerPoint, it's going to move. The importance of startup schools, getting high-performing startup schools in the mix. I would say that Hiawatha Leadership Academy is an example of how a new school starting from scratch with a focus on closing the achievement gap, we need many more of them. Interestingly, the other great schools that are mentioned, Harvest Prep, Higher Ground, CCLA, Concordia Creative Learning Academy, 3 or 4 years ago, they will tell you, their test scores were in the 40s. And they refocused on best practices, and as we'll see in a minute, those numbers are in the 60s and 70s. Good to great schools that move into high-performing schools and startups need to replicate. That's part of the Race to the Top strategy. There is a refresh strategy in Race to the Top and a closure strategy with Race for the Top. I just mentioned the Thomas B. Fordham report, which says we go Minnesota nice on bad and chronically performing poor schools. And that's something we should look at. I think the 2009 law has kicked in. We've seen this in the acceptance of new schools with the authorizers themselves. For instance, Volunteers of America this year reviewed 12 applications for new charter schools. They accepted only one. The Walton Family Foundation grant process, which in years past was kind of pro forma, that every charter school in the state would give some sort of support from Walton. They have refocused their efforts to, again, focus on the achievement gap. They are focusing on urban areas, St. Paul, Minneapolis, and First Ring suburbs. MDE, through this authorizing process, to their credit, has ratcheted up the standards, and authorizers have gone through a very rigorous process to be accepted. Here's a different sort of data map. And this is under the rubric of where do we go from here? Charter School Partners has this on our website. It's an interactive map. One of the things we've done is instead of just identifying and analyzing a school by its proficiency numbers, we have added the MDE's growth calculation in this report, and it's a way of showing how a inner city school, while their proficiency may be low, may be gaining 2 or 2.5 years of growth in the with the individual school. So we encourage you to take a look at our website. It's interactive, kind of fun. You can look at the data of every charter school in Minnesota. As part of your packet there, our executive director, Al Fan, stated in an op-ed, those schools that have closed the achievement gap or shown significant progress toward this goal, both nationally and in Minnesota, are primarily charter schools or schools that have charter-like qualities. It is simply a fact, and it just makes sense. Schools that have the flexibility and freedom to implement new policies, new curriculum, replace ineffective teachers, and serve the specific needs of children at a better chance than other organizations without this flexibility. As my 15-year-old daughter would say, duh, Dad. While, as the 2008 legislative audit showed, and other reports, charters have not performed where they should. Those schools that are closing the achievement gap invariably are charter schools. Last July, the Star Tribune put out its Beating the Odds chart, and 7 of the 10 schools that were beating the odds were charter schools. Interestingly, 3 of the other schools, the non-charter schools, had charter-like qualities. Dayton's Bluff Elementary, for instance, is part of the Wilders Foundation Achievement Plus program. When I was director of planning and economic development of the city of St. Paul, I was on the board of Achievement Plus at the beginning. And in fact, our emphasis was to ensure that the Achievement Plus program was free of district oversight and had the flexibility to do what it needed to do. Charter School Partners also did a top 10, a slightly different rubric and analysis, but a very similar result. 7 out of the 10 closing the gap schools were charter schools. In closing, just one last comment again from the op-ed that you have in front of you. I think all of us, district or charter, have come to this consensus. Whether as charter districts, self-governed, or magnet schools, we now know what works to close the achievement gap. Study after study shows that every successful high-achieving school shares similar characteristics. They include high-quality principals and teachers in every school, and the ability to replace ineffective ones. More instructional time with an extended school day and year, a commitment to using data to strengthen teaching and effectively provide differentiated instruction recognizes students' strengths and weaknesses. A culture of high expectations, whatever it takes, no excuses, attitude for success. So, thank you for the opportunity to spend some time with you this morning. I'm certainly open for questions or can come back, whatever the chair would like.
Thanks, Mr. Sweeney. Have some questions coming up, but first of all, Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Sweeney, just real quickly, your charts on closing the achievement gap. Sorry, I'm not familiar with the kind of the data or the way this is measured, but it seems that the percent in poverty measure is kind of by definition here, the definition of an achievement gap circumstance. Is there something deeper here underneath percent in poverty to really identify kind of the lowest performing students? I mean, one could argue that maybe these charter schools just cherry pick the highest performing kids in poverty. What else is there? Is there other growth or something that kind of cements this observation, or are we really just relying on the fact that there's a certain percentage of kids in poverty in these schools that happen to be performing well?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Downey. Both of these charts reflect schools that are 85% or more of children in poverty that are free and reduced lunch. I think each and every one of these schools, these charts do not chart the growth of the individual child, but as we looked into these schools, each and every one of these schools showed tremendous growth in academic, yearly academic growth. And each and every one of them had the characteristics we talked about. Incredibly strong leader, teachers that were empowered, they used data, you know, very aggressively, and they had a no-excuse mindset in how they implemented their program.
You, Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple of questions for you, sir. First of all, back on slide 8, the key drivers of academic outcomes. Could you explain under this diagram how you define your highly qualified teachers? What is it that makes up or the characteristics of them?
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you. Again, it is a combination of the implementing a philosophy. High-quality teachers, I think, is determined by how well their children are doing in the classroom. And again, each of these schools that are doing it, monitor that. And in the charter structure, there is the flexibility, a lot more flexibility, to assist teachers or to move them along to other employment opportunities, but clearly it has to be data-based and how well those children are doing in the classroom.
Mr. Chair.
Follow-up, Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are you, sir, using both formative and summative assessments? And if yes. So, what are they?
Sure.
Mr. Sweeney.
Mr. Chair, Representative. All of our school, you know, clearly a lot of the data that we have here was MCHS. We can all make the statement that one state-mandated test doth not a school reflect or an individual child reflect the whole child. We can make that a statement. However, state basic tests are basic. And when schools are at 18, 22, 28% proficiency and not showing strong growth, that's problematic. All of our partner schools use the NWA. And the NWA is administered 2 to 3 times a year. And I think the schools are, we had one of our Partner Tuesdays 2 weeks ago in which we invited our 20-plus schools. We had a session on interpreting NWA scores for leaders and for teachers. And we actually have, as one of our data-driven products that we work with our partner schools, we've partnered with TIES, the Minnesota St. Paul-based education data organization, and we've developed something called TRIO, which all of our partner schools are utilizing. It takes whatever data that the school utilizes, state MCA tests, NWA, other qualitative analyses, and schools using this product are immediately able to turn around data the next day. It isn't a test taken in May, data comes back in August, kids are gone. It literally is the next day where our schools are using data so they can be in the classroom and be able to target students that, you know, aren't meeting the individual strands.
Mr. Chair.
Other follow-up.
My last question. Erickson. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Sweeney, how many of your schools have Teach for America or maybe First Teacher or New Teacher Project teachers?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the four schools which I mentioned, Higher Ground, Hiawatha, Harvest, and CCLA, have an average of 7 or 8 TFA students in those schools. I believe Harvest and Best have 13. And of course, TFA has targeted schools that have high free and reduced lunch populations. So our inner city schools, and we have another half dozen, actually, of our schools that are utilizing TFA core members.
Thank you.
In the interest of staying on track, we have four questions to go in about 5 minutes, so let's try to make them as short as we can. Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Sweeney, I'm very excited by what you have presented, what your organization is doing. I think it's very laudable to continue to improve charter schools. My concern and my passion is that we've got many mainstream schools. How can we take these best practices, this continuous improvement approach that you have for charter schools, implement that, roll it in mainstream so there are options for our different schools across the state to pick the option that best fits their students and do that continuous improvement now in mainstream schools and not wait for, you know, years and years.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Quam.
Mr. Sweeney, go ahead.
Thank you. One of the initial purposes of charter schools was to be able to find best practices. And there's a lot of wonderful coordination now between districts and schools. In fact, we have the Gates Foundation gave a grant to Minneapolis to work closely with charter school, a compact that charters and district schools work closer together just to be able to meet what you're talking about. There's a little anecdotal, but a not to be named first ring suburb superintendent at one of their staff meetings actually had a presentation on three charter schools in their district and said, we got to do better. These folks are doing this, this, and this. And, you know, we're not going to battle them. We're gonna do a better job than they are. So, and there's also a lot of studies. This may be a little stretching, but there are a lot of studies in other cities that have a lot of high-performing charters. And the impact, in Harlem in particular, the impact of the high-performing charter schools having profound impact on the district schools and, you know, I think they are beginning to work closer together.
Representative Ward.
Mr. Chair, I'll pass and wait for Mr. Piccolo, so please put me on the list number one for Mr. Piccolo.
That's much appreciated, Representative Ward. Representative Bills, you're up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Representative Quam's point, how much, and possibly Representative Slocum, too, if she would want to chime in, but how much do you find that charter schools work together with public schools when they do find best practices? Are they partnering? Are there workshops where those teachers are engaging with each other and trying to find the best way forward? Thank you.
Mr. Sweeney.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bills, not enough. In fact, one of the characteristics of charters sometimes is that they're in silos, and there's not enough interaction between charters themselves, let alone with districts. So that is something we would greatly encourage.
And Representative Slocum, a follow-up comment to that?
Just a little bleep in here. I'm very encouraged in Minneapolis. I traveled with our superintendent, Bernadia Johnson, and we went to Chicago and we toured two charter schools because the district, Minneapolis Public Schools, is looking at doing teacher-initiated, teacher-governed schools that are in the district and sponsored by the district. It was fabulous, and the energy was amazing, and we came home just very invigorated. It was wonderful, and they are moving forward with a couple of proposals to do that. So I think you're going to see more of that. I know there's been this hardline kind of competition between the two, and I think there really should be more of a partnership because we're all in it together.
Yeah. Thank you. And if I could, to a new point, my original is, are the methods that charter, Mr. Sweeney, if are the methods that charter schools provide evidence of student accomplishment the same as how public schools provide that same data, and then what measurements do they use to track achievement? And then are there measurements that public schools are exposed to that charter schools are exempted from?
Mr. Sweeney.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bills, data analysis and products out there are very similar. And I think districts and charters basically use similar criteria and assessments for the most part.
And one last question from Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Sweeney, I want to join in the chorus appreciating your presence here today and the message, but also your organization. It's refreshing. I've met Mr. Fan several times and appreciate the focus on high-performing charters. And I was invited to go along with Superintendent Johnson and Representative Slocum to Chicago to see the high-performing charters that Minneapolis is looking to import but wasn't able to make the trip. I'm on two things. So I guess finding strategies to move from competition, which is how charters were set up, to cooperation and maybe even to get to collaboration. Mm-hmm. If you got ideas, I'm all ears. Because so far, any ideas have been, there's been a great deal of resistance. I'm on slide 17 that looks at the demographics of charters versus the state. And I'm not surprised about higher number of minority students or free and reduced because there are a number of charter schools that focus their student body on exactly that. In my district, there's the Aurora Charter School, which caters specifically to Latino students and ELL services. There's the Lighthouse of Nations, I think it is, that, Lighthouse, okay, good, I'm getting nods in the back, that caters primarily to the Somali community. And there's a number of other charter schools that really do target their services to communities of color, which causes some issues in integration and that sort of thing, but we don't have to go there today. So I'm not surprised by that. How do you explain, however, lower percentage of special ed students in charters than traditional publics, particularly given that we have some special ed, some charter schools that are 100% special ed? So that would skew the data higher than the average presence of special ed students in charters. How do we get to that piece of the slide?
Mr. Sweeney.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dabney. It's kind of curious. I mean, that is consistent. For whatever reason, the special ed numbers are very similar to district numbers. There are some special ed focused schools specifically, but I think the district probably has more districts have more resources in some of these areas. And so, I mean, that has always kind of been a curious number. I just share your...
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Sweeney.
Thank you, Mr. Sweeney, for your presentation.
Thank you.
We'll move on next to the Center for School Change. And would you identify yourself for the record, please?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Joe Nathan. I direct the Center for School Change at McAllister College. My comments reflect 40 years of being a public school teacher, administrator, PTA president, member of the State Board of PTA, as well as having three children who attended and graduated from urban public schools, a wife who just retired after three decades of being a special ed teacher in the St. Paul Public Schools, and two youngsters who work for an urban public school in this state. I am not here to talk about charter public schools or district public schools. I am here to talk about five things that the legislature might do to help produce significant improvement in student achievement. And I'm going to talk for about 8 minutes about some things that we've been able to do and learn over the last 40 years, and then try to respond to some of the very important questions you've asked about sharing best practices between outstanding district and outstanding charter schools, because I believe firmly, based on 40 years of experience and extensive research, including research that we've done for the National Governors Association and work that we're currently doing for the National Governors Association, that there are outstanding district and charter public schools, and that one of the central issues in the land is how do we learn from the most effective, whether they are district or charter. So I don't think district are better. I don't think charter are better. I think better are better. And the question is, what can we do at the local, community, state, and national level to learn from the best? And we've had some success at that, which I'd like to share. So the first page of the handout is a column from the Star Tribune, where we describe how, over a period of 5 years, with the help of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, we were able to increase overall graduation rates by almost 30 points and to eliminate, not just reduce, but to eliminate the graduation gap between white and African American students. And as you can see from this column, there was no single strategy. It started with being clear and explicit about what we were trying to accomplish. It recognized that there are outstanding ideas in district and charter public schools, and so over a period of 5 years, we brought in terrific district and charter public school teachers and administrators to work with folks. We gave them the opportunity to visit outstanding district and charter folks. We've been at this at the Center for School Change for 23 years, and this is one of the central things we learned, that there is no single strategy that can be used to reach the goals that we want, but the first thing we have to do is to be clear about what it is that we are trying to accomplish. As Lamar Alexander, the chair of the National Governors Association, when I was there, and then former Secretary of Education, now U.S. Senator, if you're not clear where you're going, any road will take you there. So we can talk more about the specific steps that were taken in Cincinnati. And again, these are district public schools, and the specific steps that were taken to eliminate the graduation gap between white and African American. By the way, during this time, the white graduation rate was increasing. So it was not a matter of white kids were declining. It was a matter of white kids were increasing their graduation rate, and African American kids, which is the major community of color in Cincinnati, those youngsters were increasing at an even faster rate, which is what I think we want to do in this and many other communities. So we did not say all the wisdom is in the district or all the wisdom is in the charter. We said the wisdom in the schools that are improving achievement wherever they are in the United States. And you'll see that we created some small schools in large buildings. We had extensive collaboration from the Cincinnati Federation of Teachers. We had faith community is involved, business community was involved, and so on. We can talk more about that if you're particularly interested. The second page of the handout is a column from the Pioneer Press that describes the importance of learning from the best schools, whether they're district or charter. I should say, and some of you are aware of this, that I, since 1989, I've written a weekly column for a variety of Minnesota newspapers, including at this point ones that serve several of the communities that are represented around this table, including Princeton and Malacca newspapers that Representative Erickson serves as in the communities that she serves, as well as in Farmington, Rosemont, Apple Valley, and so on, where I know that Chair works from. So then I want to go to some specific suggestions about what might be done. First, it seems to me that one of the most helpful things that the legislature could do in the next 2 to 3 months is be clear about 2 or 3 goals that you have for Minnesota public schools, whether they're district or charter. And we need, as all of you know, whether it's a campaign, whether it's an organization that's private sector or public sector, we need focus. We need priorities. The legislature ultimately has to decide on priorities. Corporations have to decide on priorities. School districts have to decide on priorities. One of the things that you could help the schools, the kids, and the families is by saying, over the next couple of years, here are 2 or 3 priorities that you have. I've suggested a couple. First, there's been a lot of discussion about helping kids be ready for school, and I agree, but I also think schools need to be ready for the kids, and we can talk more about what that means. It seems to me both are important. Secondly, there's a good deal of interest in reading proficiency and considerable research that shows that youngsters who do well tend to have a proficiency in reading by the end of the third grade. Finally, and many of you are aware of this, this has just come out in the last week, we have a growing percentage of youngsters entering our public colleges and universities who need to take remedial courses in reading, writing, and math. That is exactly the wrong direction that we are going in, and I believe tomorrow we're going to have a more in-depth discussion of that report. But that it seems to me that we need to reverse that trend. We've gone from 33% of the kids who enter our Minnesota public colleges and universities to 40% of the kids who enter our Minnesota public colleges and universities needing to take remedial courses. So we need, in my view, help from the legislature. And this step would not cost a dime. It would cost your energy and your focus. It would take your energy and your focus and say, here are the 2 or 3 or perhaps 4 of the top priorities that we ask schools to do in the next couple of years, and we're going to focus our work in these areas. Secondly, going to a question that several of you asked of the previous speaker, we need to learn more about the most effective district and charter public schools. For the last 14 years, our organization has convened workshops around reading, math, family involvement, and we have invited in district and charter public school folks. We've brought together people from district charter as well as people from the colleges and universities. It seems to me that one of the things that this committee might charge the Minnesota Department of Education with is an action plan. How are we going to make the best use of the finest, most effective district or charter public schools? We know that there are some extremely effective district schools throughout the state in suburban, urban, and rural areas. I'm going to talk more about a new study that names here in Minnesota of the most effective districts in the state throughout. I'm going to talk about that in just a minute. But you might charge the Department of Education and or other organizations with coming up with a work plan, and we would be honored and delighted to work with them on that. We, as I said, for the last 14 years, we've been bringing together district and charter folks to work with and learn from each other's. You might want to work with some of the leading funders in the state. I've already met with Target, for example, which has expressed an enormous interest and a $500 million commitment to increasing the literacy of youngsters, and they're very interested in meeting with state legislators to talk about how you and they might work together. I've met with Travelers Insurance, for example, which for several years has been providing free mentors for a leadership academy that we run, which, by the way, includes both district and charter folks. And they provide free mentors. The Minnesota Business Partnership, the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce have provided free mentors for both district and charter folks. And one of the things that you might want to do as a group is to sit down with some of these folks and say, all right, our priorities are this and your priorities are that. Are there some areas of overlap? And I believe the answer unquestionably is yes. And so that's something that you might do over the next couple of months. And I can tell you, having talked with at least 2 foundations, the ones that I mentioned, Target and Travelers, that they have explicitly given me permission to say that they're very interested in doing this if you're interested in doing it. Then as to the issues of funding, I'm going to talk about the Center for American Progress report in just a moment. Dwayne Benson and others have talked about focusing a priority again on high-quality early childhood education for low-income youngsters. I think considerable research from across the political map shows considerable return on high-quality early childhood education focused on low-income youngsters and youngsters from limited English-speaking families. We have had startup funds in this state. Representative Greiling and I have talked about these startup funds. It seems to me it is now time to say, if we're going to have startup funds in this state, that those startup funds should be available to replicate the finest district and charter public schools. If we are serious about recognizing excellence, we need to find excellence wherever it is, and then we need to give opportunities for people to replicate that. And there are ways we can do that, and we would be, I'd be delighted to give you a couple more details in the discussion. Fourth, there's a lot of discussion about compensatory funding, and many of you are very familiar with these debates. The Office of Legislative Auditor has done, has done a number of terrific reports. It is quite clear to me that two things are true. First, that Minnesota has been one of the most generous in the country in terms of delegating specific funds to specific districts that have high percentages of low-income kids and high percentages of students who don't speak English. And I think that's a matter of pride. But it is not, that's the first thing. The second thing is, it's not a matter of pride. As Secretary Duncan reminded us within the last week, we have one of the nation's highest achievement gaps. Now, you can bring in 30 different advocacy groups, including ours, and they'll each have their own ideas about what to do about this. My suggestion is that because the legislative auditor rightly has a very high reputation, you ask them to do research and come back to you a year from now with recommendations about how to proceed with compensatory ed in ways that will produce higher student achievement. That may include a variety of approaches people are talking about. But I think the legislative auditor rightly is to be, it deserves commendation for the excellent work that they have done. Finally, two specific things that I want to suggest that you consider doing this year. First, we have a situation now where literally thousands of kids are graduating from our public schools, district and charter, and they don't pass the state math test because we don't have a state math test. They enter in literally thousands our Minnesota public colleges and universities, and the more than half of the kids who are going to our public colleges, public two-year colleges now, have to take a remedial course, more than half, and the single largest area is math. We work with district and charter public schools throughout the United States, including many here in Minnesota, and one of the things that people say to us over and over again is, look, the kids know right now they don't have to pass a math test in order to graduate. It seems to me that the situation should end, and so I think we should resolve the differences of opinion about what skills youngsters ought to know about math, and that there ought to be a clear message from the state legislature. There are some skills in math that every youngster, district, or charter ought to have before she or he graduates, just as we have expectations before every person gets a driver's license. There are certain skills that they need. It seems to me that this ought to be resolved. Finally, every 2 to 3 years, this assessment is done to determine what percentage of Minnesota youngsters have to take remedial courses. We'll talk more about that tomorrow, and I'll be glad to answer more questions about that. But it seems to me that it would be very helpful to have that done yearly. This is not an additional burden on any school districts. This report is done as a collaboration between the University of Minnesota and the Minnesota State College and University System. Finally, I want to encourage you to take a look at the details of this report done by another group, the Center for American Progress, which has an advisory board that I thought you might be interested in, and includes everybody from Secretary Treasurer of a major national union to a professor from the University of Chicago School of Business, a vast array of people. I would say it's sort of center-left organization, but they have come to the conclusion that school districts all over the United States could be more efficient. Are there ways to spend more money effectively? Yes. Are there ways to spend the current amount of money more efficiently? Yes. This report, which just came out last week, notes that they believe that we could have a 20% increase in student achievement in this state by making use of best practices, which several of you have talked about, and that is on page 44 of this document. This is not an argument against more money. It's not an argument for more money. It's an argument that part of what we need to do is to be more efficient. And so this group, it seems to me, has done some very helpful research, and they literally have on the website, which I have given to you right here, an analysis of every district in the state. Unfortunately, not charter public schools, but every district in the state is listed with their range of efficiency between low to high. And I think it's a very valuable piece of research to point out. Finally, two last things. First, I don't think the answers are all in the district or all in the charter, but as several of you suggested, by learning from each other, we can make considerably more progress. I think it's also important to get our demographics right, and I do want to point out that we do have statistics that we've been compiling for a decade, and that the charters in Minneapolis, for example, enroll 88% students from low-income families, and the charters in compared to the district average of 65%, and that the charters in Minneapolis enroll 87% students of color compared to 69% of the district. And on the question that one of you asked about the special ed issue, we did some research about 10 years ago with Jim Eiseldyke of the University of Minnesota, and he found that youngsters with special needs identified in large schools were much more less likely to be identified as special needs in several areas if they were in smaller schools, such as alternative district schools or collaborative small schools operated by school districts or charter public schools. So one of the reasons, Representative Dabney, not the only reason, but one of the reasons for the difference in the special ed is that most charters in this state are very small, and that many youngsters, not all, but many youngsters with special needs do far better in a much smaller setting, whether they're an alternative learning center, as you have in Minneapolis, or contract alternative. So I wanted to clarify a couple of those things. But it's an honor to perform to speak with you, and I want to be clear, I'm speaking only for myself, not for McAllister College. I'd welcome any questions.
Thanks, Mr. Nathan. Questions, first up, number one, Representative Ward.
Well, I was, Mr. Chair, thank you. I was waiting for Mr. Piccolo, but I'll tell you what, I'll throw it out here right now, because Mr. Nathan made reference to it, and Mr. Nathan, you know, I started teaching in 1970-something, three or four, and you are well-known and well-respected in the area of all education, period, so thank you for all the, you know, the Schools for Change that you've done, you know, for many, many decades. You mentioned alternative learning centers that Representative Dabney has in his district, and I was an alternative education director back in the 70s. I started the alternative education program for a couple different districts. Can you just, and this is what I was going to ask Mr. Piccolo and Mr. Sweeney both, can you kind of give us the difference between like a charter and an alternative education program? Because, you know, I just think that that's important for us to recognize there are some differences there. And what are those differences? Not just structurally or governance-wise, but also, you know, some differences maybe within curriculum or things like that. Could you just do that for us, please?
Mr. Nathan.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ward, thank you for your work with alternative schools, sir. I think you and I have actually talked about that a couple of times. I want to say that there is no such thing as a typical alternative school or a district public school or a charter public school. And I want to try to be clear about that. The previous person testifying correctly noted that there are charter schools that are Chinese immersion and German immersion and core knowledge and so on and so forth. And that's also true of district schools. We have the representative of the Minneapolis Public Schools in the room. And there are a vast array of options within the Minneapolis schools. So I want to try to be clear with you that we need to be very careful about describing schools and making generalizations, which is why we've tried over the years to learn from the best, whether they're district or charter. With that as a caveat, charter public schools, as alternative schools, as district public schools, are all public. They're supposed to be open to all kinds of kids. Several of us worked together more than 25 years, 1985, to write the Area Learning Centers legislation, which allows kids who haven't succeeded according to various criteria to go to different kinds of public schools. There was the Area Learning Centers legislation and high school graduation incentives, two different pieces of legislation starting in 1985 that essentially said kids who aren't succeeding according to criteria such as being two grade levels behind, pregnant, having significant discipline problems, would be allowed to go to other kinds of schools. Some of those schools have functioned as soft jails. Some of those schools have had incredible improvement of their youngsters in aspirations and academic achievement, and we have tried to learn from some of the most effective alternative schools. But alternative schools in general, these days, area learning centers and alternative schools generally focus on kids who've not succeeded. And there are some charter public schools that do the same thing, as several of you noted. So they are all public schools. Alternative schools tend to focus on kids with whom traditional schools have not succeeded. They tend to be small. They tend to be at the 7th through 12th grade level, although the legislature has allowed, through alternative programs, school districts in large district schools to have after-school or late-afternoon programs, and those are also called alternative programs. We've gone from less than 5,000 youngsters enrolled in alternative programs in 1985 to more than 140,000 enrolled on alternative programs of various types. So the biggest growth in alternative and options in this state is not charters or post-secondary options. The biggest growth has been in the alternative programs, whether they're standalone or whether they're schools that are the after-school programs. Charter public schools and district public schools are open to a variety of youngsters. Neither alternative programs nor charter schools may have admissions tests. There are a handful of district public schools in the state that do have admissions tests. This is much more common in other parts of the country, but district public schools are allowed to have admissions tests. Charters, as the word connotes, have a contract for performance. There are also alternative schools that have a contract for performance, but one of the central ideas of the charter has been from the very beginning that there's a contract for performance, and I would say, having worked with handful of folks in this room and others on the charter law, that from the very beginning, we were concerned about quality. This wasn't just something that happened in the last 5 or 6 years. And mistakes were made, but from the very beginning, we were concerned about quality. So they're all public. Alternatives have a certain group of kids, may not have admissions tests, have to be non-sectarian, except that the state has now allowed religious groups to create alternative schools. And there are there's at least one group in Minneapolis, Plymouth Christian Youth Center, that has created an alternative school. So those are some of the similarities and some of the differences.
Just one comment, please, Mr. Chair.
Kind of like priming the pump there, wasn't Representative
like
Ward. Go ahead.
And this relates to the special ed part of piece of that, too, because I was in special education for about 22 years of my career as well. Would you say that, I mean, the statistics showed a lower percentage of special ed students in the charter school system, which also surprised me a bit, too. But would you say that this statement perhaps could give some reason for that from the standpoint of if a child was placed in a charter school or an alternative school based on their IEP, they would still be considered, they still are labeled a special ed student. But maybe a special ed student, for whatever reason, was no longer in the public school setting, but then opted to start into a charter school or a alternative school and did not have that label anymore, so they weren't designated as a special ed student. Do you follow what I'm saying here? So maybe there's some special ed kids in those schools that don't have that label because they don't have it anymore because they're not in the public school system. No,
Mr. Piccolo.
I'm not. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Nathan, I'm sorry.
I beg your pardon, Mr. Chairman, Representative. I'm going to completely confirm what you just said, and I'll use two quick examples. One comes from Minneapolis Schools. Minneapolis Schools a few years ago asked me to be the chair of their recertification program through North Central Association, and I visited about 10 different alternative schools that have contracts with the Minneapolis schools. And in a number of cases, youngsters came up to me and talked with me with great passion about how the smaller setting, the fact that there were 75 to 100 kids, that they had in some cases smaller class size, more individual attention on computers, that they didn't, that there were differences in structure. This meant that they were no longer behavior problems. And so they were no longer classified as students with behavior problems. And a number of alternative school directors in around the state can affirm what I've just said, and we have many, many examples of this. In fact, one of the most remarkable hearings that I've ever attended in this state, in this building, occurred in 1985 when some youngsters from Chisago Lakes came in here, and I'll just tell you two quick examples. There was a lovely young woman who talked about how she had been a cheerleader and on the Honor Society, and she was the oldest of 14 kids in her family, and they had major economic strife. She went looking for love elsewhere. Unfortunately, she became pregnant at 17. She was kicked out of the Honor Society. She was kicked off the cheerleading squad, and she thought about taking her own life. Fortunately, a social worker told her about an alternative school. She went there. She had the baby. She graduated. She earned an AA degree, and she's now a taxpayer in this state. And she talked about that with more eloquence and insight than I can possibly convey. The second quick example is a person from another rural district who talked about how he was the fifth of his family to go to a particular high school. All of his older brothers and sisters drank. He drank. He got there. The teacher said, oh, yeah, we know your family. He did exactly what the expectations were. He was suspended and then ultimately kicked out, went to an alternative school. They said, we don't care about your older brothers. We care about you. Once again, this young man did well, graduated, is now a taxpayer here in Minnesota. So there are many examples of this. And one of the reasons that I think the legislature in this state deserves enormous credit is that it has been willing to create new options since 1985, of which alternative schools in some cases are outstanding examples, as is true of some charters and so on and so forth. And I apologize for the lengthy examples.
Representative Brainerd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to thank you, Mr. Nathan, for emphasizing the point that we ought to be looking at the results and not the type of governance of a school. Well, I really appreciated Mr. Sweeney's presentation, and I've been a long supporter of some aspects of charter schools. As Mr. Nathan knows, I've worked in my own district to create opportunities for flexibility in governance and parental involvement and so forth. I was somewhat uncomfortable with the repeated title of a couple of your charts, that the best vehicle for closing the achievement gap is charter schools, because I think we make a mistake when we focus on the type of governance and not the data. And I think we do have districts throughout our state that are showing excellent best practice models and doing a lot of the work that you are using, a lot of the tools that you talk about. And I think we make a mistake when we don't create the conversation across types of governance to allow best practice to mature, because of the number of children that are being served in our state by traditional public schools far outweighs the numbers that charters will have the capacity to serve in any near distant future. So we do ourselves a disservice if we don't, as you said, follow the wisdom wherever it is, you know, find the wisdom wherever it is. I think it's really important that we don't prioritize one type of governance over another. So I just wanted to thank you for that focus. I wanted to also briefly address the special ed issue, and you did a very eloquent job of addressing it from the behavioral aspect. But our own experience in the Mankato School District, we have a smaller site-governed school that is very similar to a charter but is run by the district. We started out serving special ed students and changed that structural arrangement simply because some resources were not able to be extended to the smaller school environment and were better, that the students were better served in a larger school where there were more students of similar need when it came to not so much behavioral issues but some other special ed needs.
Nathan, comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a brief comment. I completely agree, and I won't take your time to tell other stories, but I do want to say, going back to the issue of charter and district people learning together, that we also provided this document for you. And this is this has been circulated more than 40,000 times as part of La Prensa, Asian News, Hmong Times, plus through the Minneapolis and St. Paul School Choice Fairs. And it includes kids from a variety of different kinds of schools who participated in post-secondary options, which several of you, including Representative Dreiling, have worked very hard to make happen and to keep alive. A marvelous program that's received national attention over and over, but has also spurred more attention to college in the schools and advanced placement and international baccalaureate, all of which are excellent programs. So this is an example of a kind of program, a kind of document that highlights outstanding work. Finally, if you are interested, as several of you clearly are, in promoting more exchanges between district and charters, two things. First, we are a part of the collaboration that Mr. Sweeney described. We received $14 million over the years from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. They asked us for advice. This is the number one thing that we proposed 5 years ago, and they have decided to follow up. And we weren't the only one. There are many others who suggested this. And secondly, we are a part of a collaboration involving the St. Paul schools, both district and charter, funded by a major multi-million-dollar federal grant, which is providing collaboration back and forth. But if it is the desire of the legislature to see more of this, it seems to me you have every right to say to various funders and foundations, look, if we do X, will you do Y? This is a time where we need to think about more collaboration across sectors, And obviously, you will do what you know you think appropriate. But it seems to me entirely appropriate for you to say that the education funders in this state, who do provide millions of dollars a year, look, we're glad to see this collaboration happening in Minneapolis and St. Paul. But how about Moundsview? How about South Washington County? How about Mankato? How about Black Duck? And so on and so on and so on. Because it seems to me that we need to pay attention through foundations like Northwest Area Foundation and Blandon Foundation, other funders who are also interested in Greater Minnesota, that these kinds of collaborations could take place and that we could again lead the country in another way, which is that the legislature could sit down with these funders and say, this is one of our priorities. If it is one of your priorities, can we do this throughout the state?
Thank you, Mr. Nathan. Excellent presentation. And last on the agenda today, we have the Minnesota Association of Charter Schools Executive Director. And please identify yourself for the record, Mr. Piccolo.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity to be here this afternoon. My name is Eugene Piccolo. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Charter Schools. And I just want to thank you for this opportunity to share a little about the association, to talk a little about what we've done in terms of improving accountability and quality and innovation through the charter school law and other activities, and then some of the public policy issues that are the purview of this committee. First, the excuse me.
Would you like a glass of water?
I'm fine. Okay. Thank you. The Minnesota Association of Charter Schools was formed about 1994 when there were less than a handful of charter schools and has grown over the years. It is a membership organization composed of the charter schools in Minnesota. It's also open to authorizers and individuals who are part of the charter school community. One of the things our focus is around quality, accountability, and innovation. And so we do some of our work is advocacy. Some of it's working with schools to improve the quality through governance, through human resource management issues, through board leadership, through administrative leadership, and then also trying to connect our schools and their ideas and resources and so forth. So that's a little about us as an organization. I do want to touch on the charter school law from 2009. In 2006, on the 15th anniversary of the charter school law, our association launched a year-long effort to look at the charter school law and say, where are the areas that we have run into continuous issues in terms of implementation of the original law? And we came up with a comprehensive list of changes that needed to be done. In fact, there were 35 major policy changes that were presented in 2009 to this legislature, and this committee and its companion committees took those proposals and passed it into law. And you have in front of you some of the major changes that were put into law. One area was in the whole area of sponsor, or now we call authorizers. We changed the name of it to reflect a different role. Because sponsor, to many people, was that they're supposed to be your friend, they're putting money into it, they're backing it in some regard. And we said, no, the role is authorizer. The role is authorizer. They have authority over these schools. They grant a charter, they're supposed to be doing oversight, and they have the authority to withdraw the charter if the school is not performing to its contract. And in the history of Minnesota, we have now had 36 or 37 schools who have been closed because they have not fulfilled the terms of their contracts. So the idea that we have never closed schools in Minnesota, charter schools, because they haven't done their job is not true. 20% or more of our schools have closed because they haven't lived up to their contract as a charter school. The other things we did as part of that is to put in place for the first time that authorizers had to meet certain standards and certain criteria in order to be an authorizer. Up until 2009, all you had to do is be a school district, a college or university, or a nonprofit with $2 million. You never had to show whether or not you had any capacity to do the job. And so this legislature put into law provisions that said you have to demonstrate you have the capacity now to do the job as an authorizer. And it also requires performance review of authorizers now. At least every 5 years, the Department of Education has to do a review of authorizers. Are they doing their job in terms of oversight? So that was another major significant change. And you can see there's other things in regard to that. The other thing we did was try to clarify the role of MDE and authorizers, because in the legislative audit report of 2008, it said there's overlap in a number of areas in terms of oversight, and there was no oversight in other areas. So now it's pretty clean in terms of who has what oversight role, and there's oversight through the whole process, not just up front and not at the end. The third area that we focused on was to strengthen charter school governance. One of the things when I came into this position as executive director, I noticed was that because charter schools are nonprofits, a number of them were getting trained by the nonprofit sector, and a number of them getting trained by the School Boards Association. And training was going like this, because charter schools are a hybrid organization of both being a nonprofit and a public institution. And there's laws that take precedence over others in different circumstances. And so what we tried to do is bring together those two aspects into training. And we supported 2 years ago mandating certain training for boards, because there was no requirement for any board training at all before 2009. So we have been very supportive of that. And we try to clean up the idea that the CEO or the executive director of the school was not a voting member and their finance person was not a voting member, because there was just too much interconnection of people on the boards. And we supported making sure there was a variety of people on the boards, including somebody from the community that is not connected to the school in terms of being an employee or a parent or guardian of somebody in the school. We also clarified conflict of interest, because there were, as was pointed out in the legislative auditor report, four different conflict of interest laws that charter schools had to comply with, and all of them conflicted with each other. So basically, this legislature said, since they're all getting federal money of some kind, we need to meet the federal standard for conflict of interest. And so that has clarified a lot of that. We also put into place a requirement that charter schools need to meet more than one purpose of the law. There are six purposes for charter schools in the 1991 law. And under the original law, all you had to meet is one. And we've said now you have to meet at least two different of the purposes of charter schools. And then we put in a requirement that said annually charter schools must start accounting for the innovation in their schools. There has never been before now any reporting mechanism for the innovation that's going on in charter schools. And there's a lot of good things happening between districts and charter schools. I'll give you two examples. Milroy, Minnesota, a small rural district in the southwest part of the state, has a unique role and organizational structure in terms of charter schools. They chartered their elementary school, and they kept their middle school, and they tuition out their high school because it's such a small district. But they have the best of both worlds, because they have a traditional district and a charter school, and the charter school is now bigger than the school district because it is attracting students from other communities. And the superintendent of the district also serves as the executive director of the charter school. It's one of the most unique models of charter school, district school cooperation in the United States. Another example of cooperation that was recognized this summer nationally was Forest Lake, and one of our charter schools in Forest Lake and the school district there. A number of years ago, parents in that district asked for a Spanish immersion school. The district was not able to do it, so parents created a charter school that is Spanish immersion. Over the years, when the kids got beyond 6th, 7th grade, the parents said, we want to continue that. So what has happened is the school district now has created a high school program So there is continuity from K-12 for Spanish immersion, so the kids can go to the charter school in the elementary grades and continue that course of study that's integrated, coordinated, all the way through 12th grade. That's another example of how these things can work and do work. As has been mentioned before, that's not always been the case. There's been competition and downright hostility at times between people in different communities, but it does show these things can happen and do happen. And where our goal was to make sure that we have accountability in terms of knowing what's going on and having that documented so we can learn and share that with other districts. The other thing that we did in this bill 2 years ago was to clarify some of the issues around facilities, which was an issue that has been on the table since 1991. And I'll talk a little bit about that more, but even back in the 2003 legislative audit report on charter schools, it asked the legislature to clean up that issue. And it was again in the 2008 report. So there have been two reports now on charter schools by the legislative auditor. And finally, it has been addressed in the 2009 legislation. And you can see some of the other things. But that law, as was mentioned earlier, has been recognized as the best charter school law in the United States. And one of the areas we're recognized for is the quality control provisions that are part of the law, that we are one of the best state in that area. And I think that's something I think this legislature can be proud of doing 2 years ago. So third, I'd like to talk a little about some of the issues going forward with regard to charter schools, especially with regard to those that deal with the areas that this committee deals with in terms of finances. So I'd like to address three areas: educational funding and the gap between traditional school districts and charter school districts, charter school facilities, which is still an issue, and then student transportation. In terms of educational funding, one of the things that we would like to point out is that while we are the leader in terms of educational funding for charter schools, because charter schools are treated as districts and therefore get all the state funding that any other district does, there's been a growing gap between traditional school districts and charter school districts in terms of funding. There was a study that just came out from Ball State about 6 months ago that looked at all states in terms of their funding for charter schools. And the gap has been growing over the last 10 years because we have shifted more to property taxes, and charter schools, of course, do not get property tax. They cannot tax. And so the gap statewide now is 13% between what a charter school gets for funding and a traditional district gets. And in Minneapolis, the gap is 21% difference in funding. In Minneapolis, for example, in 2006-07, the gap was 21.1% or $3,188 per student. In St. Paul, it's about 13.5%, and this is based back in 2006-2007. So this has been a growing gap because of the shift to property tax. So our concern is that as we continue to shift to property tax funding, that we are creating a bigger gap in terms of resources for charter school students. So we would ask that the legislature look at the equalization of referendum aid, which has slowly declined also. A few years ago, for example, in St. Paul, if St. Paul has a referendum of about $600-some per kid, a student from St. Paul who went to a charter school in St. Paul would bring about $138. Now it's down to $28 and will disappear completely next year. So there's this gap that we would ask you to look at. Second, we would ask you to look at the issue of the funding from the permanent school fund, which two or three years ago was changed, and charter schools no longer get that funding. Not that anybody ever got it because the way it was funded, but now it's in addition to the basic formula,
And according to the Constitution and all statutes, charter school students should be eligible for that funding. Third, we would ask for you to consider some kind of assistance in terms of helping charter schools get access to low-income interest loans because of the 70-30 shift. Because charter schools don't have the ability to tax locally, they pay a higher interest rate because there's no collateral locally to back up that the state will pay back the 70-30. And so our schools are paying much higher interest rates, which is money out of the classroom for that purpose. We would also encourage you to carefully look at the implications for look in terms of compensatory education. As was pointed out, we have twice as many kids in terms of poverty as traditional districts, and that is especially true in the two urban centers, which would be ultimately majorly affected by a significant change in that formula. So those are areas in terms of funding. In terms of facilities, we would ask the legislature to relook at the basic policy that has been in existence since 1991, that charter schools cannot directly own facilities. Last year, there was a significant piece of legislation considered by both bodies with regard to charter school facilities. It was a very complex bill, but it was a very comprehensive bill. And if you look at our little brochure there with our positions, a lot of those issues there would have been resolved by that legislation, and we would hope at some point the legislature would relook at the issue of facilities again for charter schools. And finally, we would ask the legislature to look at the whole issue of both policy and funding for student transportation. At one time, most of our schools used traditional district transportation. Today, about 75% of our schools do their own transportation. And we know transportation is an issue that every district basically has to take money out of the general fund for. And we would call on the legislature maybe to have a legislative audit report to look at the whole transportation system, both in terms of policy, design of the system. With we have so many kids, not just in charter schools, but in all kinds of choice programs, going across district lines and all kinds of things, and yet we still have a transportation system based on districts instead of traffic patterns and all kinds of other things. And there's technologies that can be used to make this system much more efficient vehicles. A couple years ago, we were ranked as having some of the most inefficient vehicles in terms of transportation for students in the country. Other states are doing things in terms of investing in vehicles that are much more inefficient. So I think that's an issue we believe that, you know, affects all of public education, and we strongly support that. So with that, I would be open to questions.
Thank you, Mr. Piccolo. And as of now, we have nobody on the question list. Quick adjourn. Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Nature abhors a vacuum. This one, I was a couple minutes late to the committee, so it may have already been announced or explained, and I got a little bit of an answer from Chair Erickson. But could you? Why are there two? Why is there your charter school organization and then the earlier testifier?
Mr. Piccolo.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greiling, I think we both are different kind of have different purposes in particular. Mr. Sweeney can speak for himself in terms of what, you know, and did about the focus of their organization. Our organization, as I mentioned, is a membership organization. It's focused around certain types of activities, both in terms of advocacy and also member services. And they're more of a service organization that has focused around new schools and some other things.
Mr. Sweeney, any further comments?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative. I mentioned earlier that our organization is actually fashioned after the New Schools for New Orleans organization. Our executive director, Al Fan, is down there right now, actually, working with a national group. And that is a real focus on incubation, going very deep And interestingly, in Louisiana, for instance, New Schools for New Orleans and the Louisiana Association of Charter Schools work hand-in-hand, complementary. So some of the things like we talked about, we are the Walton Family Foundation partner here in Minnesota, and it really is almost a, we're seeing this in a lot of states, similar type of charter support groups plus the association.
Thank you.
Thanks. If there are no further questions, Representative Chairman Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm assuming we're done with testimony now and with questions. Okay. Just a note for members that tomorrow we have two bills up that we'll be voting on, the Alternative Pathways to Licensure Bill as well as Representative Depke's bill regarding the maintenance of effort, and members should plan on casting votes on both those bills. In the event that we are not done within the allotted committee time, I'm hoping we'll have this room reserved after the floor session to vote on that on Thursday night, but plan on passing or us voting on both those items tomorrow. And if you have any questions, I feel free to answer those right now.
Any questions? Thanks, Mr. Chair. If not, today's meeting is adjourned.